Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, February 14, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Real Vision's own Weston Nakamura. Lots happening right now. Let's take a look at U.S. equity markets. It looks like S&P 500 pairing some of the losses on the day to close negative 0.39% at 4,401, right at the 44 handle. NASDAQ dead flat on the day, 0.0%. Looks like it's off about a quarter of a percentage point, closing out the day at 13,790. Dow Jones Industrial Average also off about half a point. Russell 2000 off a third of a point, settling at 2,222. Dow Jones Industrial Average settling at the day, 34,565 points. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening out in the world today. The United States has evacuated diplomats and military advisors from Ukraine after a statement from the Biden administration on Friday that a Russian invasion could come, quote, at any time. Word out today that diplomatic efforts are still ongoing. European stocks closed the session down. Stocks Europe 600, that's a broader European index, ending the session down 1.8%. Russia is the world's second largest exporter of natural gas after the United States and a major supplier to European energy markets. Finally, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard, a voting member of the Federal Open Markets Committee, reaffirmed his view today that the Federal Reserve needs to, quote, front load their withdrawal of policy accommodation, adding, quote, our credibility is on the line here. Weston Nakamura, any thoughts on today's news?
Yes. Happy Valentine's Day, Ash, first of all.
Thanks.
More importantly, you're welcome. Second thought on the news. So regarding the Russia headlines, Russia-Ukraine headlines, they absolutely do move markets. This is very evident if you actually look at this chart I have. It's basically just two charts. The top one is intraday. I basically have it set to Central European time, but that spike up that you see, that is, you know, when you got this headline shortly before U.S. cash open, and you could see the euro ruble cross, which is inverted on the chart, so as to make it, you know, easier to visualize. But you can see that slightly leads, you know, E-minis. And then the bottom half of that chart is sort of a longer term kind of a year-to-date thing. In the beginning of the year, obviously, the euro-ruble cross has really nothing to fundamentally do with E-minis until, you know, this geopolitical crisis start to really escalate and therefore impact markets, and you can start to see more of a tighter correlation. So,
let me just explain what we're looking at here. So as the euro-ruble strengthens, meaning the ruble declines against the euro, you see the S&P 500 E-minis as a proxy begin to sell off.
Yeah, not really as a proxy. It just means it's so, like, you know, euro ruble basically. So if the euro,
I meant E-minis as a proxy for S&P 500.
Oh, right, yeah. So basically, if the ruble is weakening against the euro, it's generally, you know, investors that are getting bearish Russia because Russia is getting, you know, aggressive and heading towards something that might look like a conflict or a potential war or whatever it might be. And then the reversal is, you know, a reversal of that kind of sentiment. So
in the simplest terms, as investors perceive challenges in the Ukrainian region, you see this deterioration in equity market pricing. And that's also reflected in the cross pair between the euro and the ruble.
Yeah, more so what I would say is that if you're looking for what, you know, especially if there's an intraday move, like, you know, like this chart, the top part of this chart, if you're looking for a reason for why the market is moving, you know, was it a Fed speaker? There's like, you know, well, a whole bunch of them this week. Was it something else? Was it a piece of data? Was it a headline from Ukraine? If you look at, you know, if you look at this cross rate and then you just throw it on top of a chart of, you know, a live chart of E-minis or NASDAQ or whatever it might be, you can more or less see what's moving markets. And in this case, it is indeed these, you know, Russia and Ukraine headlines.
Yeah, so not just the correlation, but also the directionality of the correlation.
Yeah, and the if it's actually the relevant driver or not.
Yeah, we should say also in the story about President Bullard, any thoughts on this notion of a sitting FOMC member stating that the credibility of the Federal Reserve is on the line if a policy accommodation does not get withdrawn quickly, meaning rates rise quickly or the Fed begins to lose credibility? That's essentially what Bullard is saying.
Yeah, I don't have any anything specifically about that comment, but as a concept, absolutely. I said in my video on the Bank of Japan, which we'll get into in a moment, but what central bankers, the most important thing to them is credibility. It's their currency. Without credibility, they have nothing. Look at the CBRT of Turkey, right? Like, if you don't have credibility, you don't have anything. And the reason that that's so important is to maintain at all times is that if you do something with monetary policy, such as this, take this negative interest rate in Japan that's been there since January of 2016, that has been policy error evident within an hour of the announcement of it, yet they've kept it on this entire time. The reason that they can't pull that out is because the second they do, they lose credibility. And if they lose credibility, whatever is immediately going to replace that failed policy, even if it's seen as a failed policy from years ago, that's not going to work because you don't have any credibility. So you need to maintain credibility. So what Bullard's saying is absolutely right in terms of maintaining credibility.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hey, Weston, perfect segue into a point that I wanted to raise, which was your video last week, why global markets are addicted to the Bank of Japan. I know we have a lot of U.S. investors who are watching this who are not following the Bank of Japan as closely as you are. So just to tee that up for us, give us the context, explain the broader significance of the Bank of Japan to global asset markets.
Sure. So for the full explanation, I'm not going to regurgitate the whole video right now, but please feel free to take a look at it. It's on YouTube. And for everyone who has seen it and who commented and all that, thank you very much for all the support. Means a lot to me. Basically, what's going on is the following. Bank of Japan is a major central bank. This is the third largest economy in the world. For whatever reason, at a time when central banks are under the microscope, under a lot of scrutiny, Bank of Japan is not part of the conversation at all. Everyone is looking at every central bank as they should be. But the reason that that's kind of very crazy to me is because Bank of Japan is, in my view, the most significant of all of them. And the reason is because at a time when global central banks are removing accommodative policy that's basically been in place for, let's call it, a decade, and they're basically removing it as if there's no consequences, right? They're just going to, they're going to hike rates, they're going to, or are expected to, or they're going to, stop with their bond buying or whatever their method of accommodative policy is. They're one by one removing them, and that leaves the Bank of Japan as the only central bank that is actively still easing, not just not tightening, but they're still easing. And so what kind of implications does that have on global risk assets when you have just this one central bank that's left doing it? Can they do it? Will they do it? And what happens if they cannot or will not, keep, kind of global asset markets in order as they have been accustomed to for the last 10 years. But either way, if this is the last major central bank that's still doing this, that's a heavy burden to carry. And the fact that nobody is looking at the Bank of Japan is kind of baffling to me.
Well, let's talk about that. Talk about the policy mechanisms that are in play. I saw a statistic in your video that was really striking, which is that the BOJ owns approximately 135% of Japanese GDP on their balance sheet. By way of contrast, we've been talking about the nearly $9 trillion in U.S. dollar denominated debt that the Federal Reserve owns. That is only 35% of U.S. GDP on the Fed's balance sheet. You can see this series at WALCL on the St. Louis Fed FRED database. Bottom line, this is like a significant, almost fourfold increase from where the U.S. is. Give us a sense of the context for just how much accommodation the Bank of Japan has unleashed on the Japanese economy.
Sure, absolutely. So the reason that that's important to look at is because sometimes people just look at the nominal figure of the balance sheet size, and that's meaningless unless you compare it against, right, you know, relative against the, you know, and so by looking at it as a ratio to GDP, by far Bank of Japan is the most intensely aggressive in terms of their policy easing. So Brian, right, if you go to the chart, the purple charts, so on chart one, this is basically just a chart of 10-year JGB yield and yield curve control, which is what I'm focusing on. Yield curve control is the most consequential and most radical policy of major central banks in the last half decade. The reason people don't realize that is because it's kind of going on in the background. But just because it's going on in the background, it doesn't mean that it's not significant, and it certainly doesn't mean that...
Well, let's explain what it is, because the yield curve control, yep, that the Bank of Japan is doing is different from what the Fed is doing here in their policy accommodation by keeping rates low. Give us the context for YCC.
Sure. So what Bank of Japan has done is, leading up to yield curve control, they have amassed something like a little bit under like half of all JGBs outstanding. All right, so they've already kind of cornered the JGB market as it is. So that sets it up for yield curve control. What yield curve control is literally, it's self-explanatory. It's controlling the yield curve. There's two components. It's the front-end policy rate, which is at minus 0.1. That's the negative interest rate that they did in January of 2016. And then from September of 2016 onwards, what they started to do was they pin the 10-year JGB yield at around zero. And that around zero is, it's a very kind of flexible figure up for interpretation of both the markets and the JGB. But the way that they control the long end, the 10-year, which is something that's unprecedented in modern central banking, what they do is they do one of two things. They buy JGBs either by what's called a competitive auction or a fixed rate operation. Competitive auction is basically just their standard, just JGB buying. It's pre-announced. They say exactly what, you know, tenor, what the quantity is, what the date is, and they execute those buys at 10:10 a.m. on the days that they're buying. The other one, the fixed rate operation, is rarely used. That's when the Bank of Japan announces that they're going to step into the market and they're going to buy an unlimited amount of JGBs at this specific tenor at this specific price. And if you have an unlimited printing press, theoretically, you have a wall of buying that caps yields to the upside. And so that's what that's how yield curve control just generally works.
Weston, I know that there's some news on precisely this front that we're going to get to in a second here, but I want to bring this back for people who are listening to this who are not necessarily following macro policy as closely as you are. I want to give them the context for why this matters. Give us the sense for why yield curve control and monetary policy in Japan has an impact on global rates, first of all, and then second, to the meat and potatoes, to how this affects U.S. equity market investors, what the impact of rates in the U.S. and globally has on U.S. equity markets.
Sure. So in chart two, Brian, chart two, you'll see that this is the same thing, the 10-year JGB with yield curve control. And then I've also thrown on top of it the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. That's all that is. And what you'll see is that the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield seems to more or less directionally move in line with 10-year JGBs or vice versa. What the significance of this, of yield curve control, is that Japanese households, just take the households, for example, they're sitting on 14 trillion yen or $14 trillion of cash, essentially. The majority of their assets are in cash. Hence the deflation, their cash hoarding culture. Same with the corporates, same with, you know, asset managers. They're holding a ton of cash. They have a ton of firepower, and they have, they're in need of yield because the Bank of Japan is pinning the 10-year yield, the long end, at zero. So you're literally getting, there's no yield to get in Japan. So what that does is it forces Japanese investors to go overseas, like to the U.S. Treasury market, and buy U.S. Treasuries and, you know, and collect yield. And so, therefore, when Bank of Japan caps yields on JGBs at, via yield curve control, they're essentially, what they're doing is they're doing indirect yield curve control on the U.S. Treasury market and even on European sovereign rate markets as well, because Japanese investors are buying U.S. Treasuries and all that, and that caps U.S. Treasury yields. And
if by the way, that's a big idea, the idea that one central bank, the Bank of Japan, could be effectively anchoring rates globally because of the cash flow coming out of the country as Japanese investors seek a return on investment, seek yield. They're pulling down rates elsewhere. This is a big concept.
Yeah, it's something that I think is completely, you know, overlooked by a lot of people. This is exactly why, you know, why it's such a big mystery to people who look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield and say, like, oh, how could it be under 2% with the 7 handle on CPI, or, you know, because the Fed is doing this? Because the reason that those things don't match up is because the U.S. Treasury market is not just a U.S.-based market. It's a global right. market. There are global investors, all with their own sort of needs and whatever it may be. And Japanese investors will unconditionally buy U.S. Treasuries because U.S. Treasuries are, first of all, they're always safer than JGBs because Japan has the highest debt in the world, 250% debt to GDP. So even with like U.S. Treasury U.S. like Congress, you know, debt ceiling theater, all of that kind of stuff, even with that, it's still safer than JGBs.
So the question you're answering here, Weston, is this idea. Why is it that we see inflation rising in the U.S., but you don't see the massive takeoff in yields, a decline in price in U.S. Treasuries? You're saying it's because of basically central bank policy action coming out of the BOJ, which is causing these hot cash flows here into the United States, creating demand and therefore suppressing yield. I believe you pointed out in your video that the largest foreign buyer of U.S. Treasury debt is Japan, and it is by a wide margin. I think it's $1.3 trillion relative to about $1 trillion coming from China. These are significant, significant cash flows.
Indeed. They're exporting their monetary policy. They're exporting this, you know, demand for yield. So if you go to the third chart is basically this is how the Bank of Japan buys, you know, controls the yield curve. This is the two ways they do it. The left side is the regular buying schedule. The right side is this fixed rate operation where they buy unlimited. They offer to buy unlimited, cap the yield curve. And the fourth chart, this is the most sort of kind of recent, like what's going on right now. Right now, the Bank of Japan has a yield curve control. They have the upper bound set at 25 basis points. 25 basis points is where the Bank of Japan is going to step in theoretically and offer to buy an unlimited amount of JGBs.
Yeah, this is at the 10-year duration.
Correct. And you could see, again, this is what the U.S. 10-year U.S. Treasury yield also thrown on top of it. And you can see that that 25 basis point level, that was like basically that it was, you know, the 10-year JGB yield was right there. Then last week, like literally as I was making the video, this is what happened. But that level wasn't really breached, but the BOJ came out and made a very sort of unprecedented announcement in which they announced a fixed rate operation in which they're going to buy an unlimited amount of JGBs. But they did that like in advance. So they said that on Monday, so today, we will be conducting a fixed rate operation to buy an unlimited amount of JGBs at 10-year JGBs at 25 basis points. What's crazy about that, or what's you know, very unprecedented about that, is that first of all, when the Bank of Japan conducts these fixed rate operations to buy an unlimited amount of JGBs, they do so like right on the spot, like during the daytime. If yields get too high, they'll step in like out of nowhere and they'll just offer to buy unlimited amount of JGBs, and then that caps yields. I've never seen them like do it in advance. like especially like days in advance like this. So that was a very peculiar thing. And the other crazy thing about that too was that they're offering 25 basis points, which is below market rate. So they're offering a buy below market rate. So that to me says that, and I don't know for sure, but the reason that they're doing that is because I think that what they're doing is kind of a defensive move where they are essentially, sometimes what happens is when they announce a fixed rate operation, that announcement in and of itself, the threat of the announcement or the announcement itself will kind of threaten the market, and the market will just back off from it. They won't have to actually conduct an actual fixed rate operation in which they actually get filled on these buys and sells.
Yeah, I think that's critical because this is the new news here. This is the update coming off of your last week's piece.
Correct. Yeah. So what they did was like ahead of a 3-day weekend at like 6 p.m. they announced that on the following Monday at 10 a.m. they're going to conduct a fixed rate operation and the rate was set at below that current market level. And so my takeaway from that was that they believe that come Monday, today, that the 10-year JGB yield would be yielding far higher than 25 basis points. And so 25 basis points would be, you know, they basically saw a bond market crash coming in the near term. And this was ahead of like right before like US CPI was announced and all that too. Yeah. So,
and as you pointed out in your video, I believe, or if you're pointing out on Twitter, this happened essentially at the moment of the coin toss during the Super Bowl. If you wanted to bury something, you couldn't have picked a better time to do it. Something I don't want to bury, though, Weston, because it's exactly on point with what we're talking about here. It's a clip from a show that aired on Real Vision Today called How the End of the Asset Bubble Era Will Lead to a New State of Capitalism. This is a conversation between Alfonso Pecatiello and Victor Schwetz. This is a conversation that aired today on the Essential Plus and Pro tier. Let's take a look at that clip.
What I would argue is that in Japan, we have seen the first experiments a while ago where Japan, in the late 80s, created a lot of credit through the government and through the private sector. It went all through the private sector and then also into asset prices. And then when the Bank of Japan decided to raise real interest rates, literally above what they thought, was neutral, the whole thing immediately collapsed. So we have seen this experiment on and on again, Victor, but are we getting closer to the point where this game is more difficult to play because as our star is getting lower and lower, real interest rates need to be even lower than a very low R star. So does it not become more and more difficult to play this game?
It is. It is. And that's your marginal utility of money. You can convert it into velocity of money. You can convert it to marginal utility of money. Your returns are getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually you reach the stage that zero volatility is the only acceptable outcome. And so what we've been trying to argue, and what I've been trying to argue, and a lot of other people did as well, that we must stop what we're doing and move into a different mode of operation or different economic scheme. Now, the problem is that most people believe still that the private sector is a primary driver of economic outcomes. And to argue that after 3 or 4 decades of what we have done, to argue after decades of technological disintermediation, private sector is no longer the driver and will never again become a major driver.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Alfonso and Victor echoing precisely the points that you made, Weston. Alf saying the BOJ has essentially become a laboratory for global central bank policy, and Victor Also following by saying, most people don't believe the private sector is the primary driver of outcomes. And quote, the private sector is no longer the driver and will never become the major driver again. Pretty extraordinary statement, Weston.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary phenomenon. It's a pretty standard statement, but yeah.
And so congruent with the points that you're making here, talking of which, tie this together for us, bring it home. We've talked about these historic relationships between global central bank policy, global yield curves. Tell us why this is so significant to U.S. equity investors, the relationship between U.S. Treasury rates and the valuation of U.S. equities, particularly growth stocks here in the United States.
Yeah. So the reason that this matters is not because of nobody cares about the JGB market. I get that, because nobody owns JGBs, because the Bank of Japan owns all JGBs. The reason this matters to global investors cross asset is because the Bank of Japan has essentially been holding together this house of cards of global markets as we know it for the last several years, in which low rate environments have significant consequences. They have consequences on things like, yeah, the S&P 500, which is largely led by the mega cap tech stocks with their insane valuations, or maybe not insane, but they're, you know, very high valuations. You know, when you basically have like growth stocks and you know, like tech sector and things like that, when you have like low interest rates, what happens is, like, are you saying, like, you want me to explain how that works?
Right? Yeah, like, please explain that transition to that mechanism for transmission, because I think it's such a critical one for people to understand why this is all so relevant to their essentially U.S. equity portfolios, particularly people who are invested in large cap tech stocks.
Yeah, so basically what happens, the reason that you're seeing like a NASDAQ sell-off in, you know, year to date from the beginning of the year is because of this rising rate environment. And what happens like on a fundamental sort of level is that basically if you have, you know, like a high growth tech company and you have high valuations, that's based on like these future profits, right? So higher interest rates means that, you know, earnings that you're pulling forward years from now are essentially like worth less today, right? And so that's why like valuations get hit, right? And so when you see like, you know, like the maybe not Facebook, because that's kind of idiosyncratic, 25% down, you know, down a day, but when you see like the tech sector get, you know, sold off, that's, you know, largely a function of that, you know, of rising rates. So basically, if the Bank Japan is capping global yields, or at the very least the 10-year risk-free rate in the U.S. or long, you know, long rates in the U.S. Via yield curve control, then what they're doing is they're artificially capping you know, interest rates, you know, in the U.S. and therefore they're allowing for tech shares and all that and the S&P to unconditionally rise, and so that's what we've been enjoying all along. It also, what that does is it allows for, it enables like the Jay Powells and the Christine Lagardes to essentially, you know, to be behind the curve. It gives them time, right? Because they're not facing, you know, they're fine. They're facing like a CPI that's rising, but they're not looking at that, you know, they're not seeing a commensurate move in bond yields. And that allows for them to, you know, drag their feet. It allows for Congress to, like, you know, have absurd deficits, and so it goes far beyond just your, you know, like your growth portfolio, but certainly that too. But the point is that right now we're at an inflection point where the Bank of Japan is trying to hold the line at this upper bound of yield curve control. If they're unable to do so and JGB yields burst through that, you know, 25 basis points, then you're going to see a sell-off in global bond markets, and so bond yields are going to rise everywhere. If that happens, you're going to see a much more of a sell-off in, you know, in S&P and in risk assets, and you're looking at a totally different world, especially at a time when, you know, the Fed is supposed to hike rates every single meeting, you know, for the rest of 2022 and the rest of global, you know, GM markets, economies are also supposed to, you know, tighten policy and all that too. So Bank of Japan is the most consequential. It should be the most focused on because it's the one that's keeping everything together. Whether or not they can, who knows? But it seems like for now they can. So, like, personally, I would take a, if I were to take a market view, I would go on a very short-term basis. I would go long U.S. Treasuries right now because they seem to be able to cap the U.S. You know, yields, 10-year JGB yields, and therefore, you know, global yields. You have to really watch these levels. You have to watch what the Bank of Japan is doing, because if they're unable to maintain the cap on JGB yields, then everything could just fall apart. Like, the world as we know it in terms of financial markets will be totally different absent the Bank of Japan's yield curve control policy.
Weston, you've done the very impressive here today. You've tied it all together, the macro and the micro, a global central bank policy to U.S. equity valuations. Obviously, a huge amount of information to get in a 30-minute show, but a very interesting framework for people to think about. And my takeaway from this, Weston, is that people who are watching the show, U.S. equity investors, are going to probably think differently about the Bank of Japan, its role in the global monetary system, its role in controlling interest rates, and the correlation between those rates and valuations. Well done, sir. Question for you. Final takeaways, key thoughts that you'd like to bring together for people as we close this conversation.
I'll just give 15 seconds on this last chart. Brian, if you bring up that last chart on the yen. If anyone wants any sort of guide on, you know, potentially where U.S. Treasuries are headed or what might be driving it, if you look at dollar yen, this is a chart of dollar yen, this is month to date, and then this is the bottom is sort of a longer term, and you can see that they very much move like very close in tandem. This is the impact. What I'm showing here is the impact and the, you know, the firepower that the Japanese investor or these sort of flows have on the U.S. Treasury market and vice versa. So watch things like yen positioning on CFTC futures. There's a ton of yen shorts. What they're doing is hedge funds playing this divergence, this policy divergence between, you know, the U.S. Fed and BOJ and all that. But, you know, keep a very close eye on the yen because it's a risk off safe haven sort of instrument. If you see something happen with Ukraine and you get a ton of short covering, that's going to crash. You know, it's going to have a pullback on yields. It's going to have a pullback on have a pullback on equity markets and things of that nature too. So it's very interconnected and all that, and it is, you know, a lot of these Japanese like assets are very much like the glue of everything, you know, in terms of markets that as we know it over the last several years. So
yeah, very interconnected indeed, and an excellent explanation for just why the interconnections exist the way they do, and some things to look at for people trying to understand these markets more broadly. Weston, as always, a pleasure to have you on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Thanks again for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Alf will be back tomorrow with Tony Greer. As always, the conversation continues on Real Vision's The Exchange. Thanks for watching, everyone.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.